So if you remember at the end, she's now totally committed to the groom because she's going to ascend the mountain of myrrh. She's going to accept the suffering. She encounters him as Gethsemane, and then he does a test on her again where she doesn't feel his presence for a while. And she goes and says to the other people in the church, you know, where's my beloved? Have you seen my beloved? And they say, basically, what's so great about your beloved? And then she tells them. And she goes through this beautiful thing at the end of 5. And we talked about all these things, the alabaster and all these things. So the last line of that is what was important to that chapter is, this is my beloved, this is my friend. Remember, we have to know the concept that Jesus is our friend. He's our brother. Remember in Hebrews, he said he's not ashamed to call us brethren. And then he also tells his disciples, I don't call you slaves, I call you friends, because a slave doesn't know what his master's doing, but you guys know what I'm doing, and you guys are going to be intimately involved in what I'm doing. So therefore, I call you friends, not slaves. So he's our friend. Like that song says, the God of angel armies, you know, he's always at our side. The one who reigns forever, he is a friend of mine. And yeah, we're a friend we have in Jesus. There's a lot of songs. And so there's this idea that he's my beloved and he's my friend. And we talked about how he's so, in his humanity, he's related to us because he has flesh and blood like we do. But when he was here, he had flesh and blood like we do. Now he still has flesh, but he doesn't have blood. He has a glorified body, but he still has a human body. And when she describes all the beautiful things about him, you know, she does like this testimony where, you know, people say to me sometime, well, you know, you believe all that stuff, but, you know, so what? I mean, why is Jesus better than any of these other guys? So when you start going through all the attributes that he has, it kind of gets you excited too. So as you do kind of the witnessing, evangelization, the testimony, and, you know, 1 Peter 3:15, it says, you always should be ready to give an explanation for the hope that lies within you with gentleness and respect. So you're always ready to explain. You don't hit him over the head with your Bible, or you don't yell and scream at him and say, unless you believe me, you're going to hell right now. But you're supposed to do it with gentleness and respect, which isn't always easy. Especially when somebody's laughing at you, which happens. So then we went just the first, I think, 3 verses. And you see at the beginning of 6, you know, the other women, the women of Jerusalem say, where's your beloved gone that we may seek him with you? In other words, now they're impacted by what she just said. So now they say, we want to seek him too. This is like when Jesus talks to the woman at the well. And she goes back in the town. And then all the townspeople go out because of what she said. Then they say, well, we went out because of what you said. But now that we see him ourselves, now we're here because of him. So, you know, her evangelization has now made them interested in seeking him. And verse 3 is where we ended up. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. So this is the key. This is the heart of the thing. You know, it's the bride and the groom. They're intimately associated. They're one together. And even though he's eternal, and he's the God-man, he's still the groom, the brother, the friend, and all these things. And remember in that chapter, he started calling her my sister, my spouse, which was the first time. So now we're going to do the rest of 6, which is pretty excited too. So now he's been kind of quiet. The groom's been quiet while all this has been going on. She's been upset that she feels he's not there. She preaches about him. She wants him back. does this beautiful description of him, and then he answers. So he breaks his silence because of what she just did. And the first thing he does is to praise her beauty again. Remember, I think there's 13 times during the whole song where he says how beautiful she is. So now he gets into the fact that she has just expressed her love for him. So now he says, oh, that's beautiful. You're beautiful. Because now he sees that her heart is willing and on fire. And when, you know, Augustine said that we should want God to say to us, oh, it's so awesome what you just did. I mean, that's what we should live for. You know, it's kind of like, well done, good and faithful servant. When you die, you want Jesus to say, well done, good and faithful servant. Not, well, that God praises us, maybe praise isn't a good word, but you know what I mean. Like excited about something that we did. Compliments us, yes. And again, see, somebody read verse 6. I mean, I'm sorry, verse 4.
You are as beautiful as Kisra, my beloved, as lovely as Jerusalem, as awe-inspiring, as bannered
tree. Okay, now what's Kisra? Kisra was this beautiful city that had all kind of gold and precious stone decorations. I don't remember all the details of it, but it was a beautiful city of the Canaanites, and it was a capital of one of their kingdoms. Joshua talks about it in Joshua 12:24. And then when Israel splits after Solomon dies, it becomes one of the capital cities of the north in 931 BC. You can read that in 1 Kings 14:17. It's in the land of Manasseh. And the people from the tribe of Manasseh are now being airlifted home from northern India. So they're back in the land now too. But Kisra was known for this beautiful decoration on all their buildings. So now he says, you're as beautiful as Kisra. Like, we don't know what that is, but they knew what it was. And the fact that Solomon's writing this book before the kingdom splits, everybody knew about Kisra. And Jerusalem, of course, is God's dwelling place. The temple was there. The word of God always goes forth from Jerusalem. And if you read Isaiah 2 and Zechariah 14, it's all about how awesome Jerusalem is. So, you know, if he's comparing her to this beautiful city, and he's also comparing her to Jerusalem, which is the center of it. So he's saying, you're physically beautiful, and now you're spiritually beautiful, too. The temple was very beautiful. You know, it was one of the wonders of Solomon's temple was one of the wonders of the world. But it was also spiritually beautiful, because it was the place where God put his name. So he compliments her at a pretty high order. Physical beauty and spiritual beauty. Then an army with banners is victorious. You know, if you can imagine an army marching somewhere with banners, they're powerful, they're victorious, they're strong, and she's now gone through her time of testing. And she passed again. She hasn't done anything yet, except agree with him. She hasn't done a thing yet. She hasn't taken a single dollar to the homeless shelter. She hasn't helped a single guy who's laying on the street. She hasn't said, you know, she hasn't been someplace praying all day. But she's gone through this time of testing, and she's conquering her fear and her doubt. So she's maturing. Part of the maturing as a believer, and part of the maturing as the whole church, capital C, is that, you know, you got to conquer your fear and your doubt, because you got to know that he's there, and he's guardian, and he's leading, and the Holy Spirit's always there, and you don't sit in the church going, oh, I don't know what's going to happen to us. Oh, I don't know what's going to happen. Maybe the whole thing's going to fall apart now, because the whole thing is never going to fall apart. Because, you know, we learn that on multiple levels. So she's conquering her fear and her doubt. And she didn't compromise. So when these other people say to her, okay, so what's so great about your beloved? Which means they've got other beloveds. Remember we talked about that? Because they specifically say, what's so great about your beloved? You know, we got beloveds too. And she didn't say, well, maybe they're right. Maybe my beloved's okay and they got some cool beloveds too. But no, she stood and said, let me tell you about them. So she didn't compromise and she evangelized. So that's why he's happy. That's why she's like an army with banners. That gets me pretty excited. It's so easy to compromise. Like when somebody starts telling you stuff and you're sitting there going, well, maybe they're right. See, my life would be a lot easier if I didn't get so carried away with all this stuff. I could live like a normal person. I don't want to, but sometimes you think that. Or if somebody's always haranguing you about how ridiculous it is what you're doing, after a while you start to say, well, maybe it is kind of ridiculous. Maybe I should go learn how to play golf instead. Let's read 5.
Turn your eyes from me, for they torment me. Your hair is like a flock of goats streaming down from Gilead.
Oh, here we go again with all these descriptions. I really like goats, but I never really thought about that as kind of a beauty thing. I always thought of them as kind of comical, but smelly. They're kind of fun to play with or take your kid to see the goats. But I don't say, wow, look at that beautiful goat. But you see, this is a language of extravagant love. Because he's now telling her how beautiful she is. Again, in big extravagant terms. He's overwhelmed by her. Superlative, all superlative stuff. He's overwhelmed. He's so excited about how she spoke about him, how she went through the time of the testing. And actually, he now has an emotional response to this. You know, we actually can cause God to be emotional in one direction or the other. You know, we can, you know, when they say the angels have a party every time one sinner repents, you know, that's kind of cool. But, you know, we actually can cause God to have emotions based on what we do and what we say. Because after all, he's a personal being. He has emotion. I don't know if Allah has emotion. And so he's overwhelmed by this. You know, and what overcomes him? See, he says something here. Turn your eyes from me. It's the look from her eyes that overwhelms him. Remember last week he said, just one glance. He's happy with if she just glances at him. Amazing. So if you glance at him, he's happy. Imagine if you have your eyes fixed on him, how happy he would be. He says, turn your eyes. He's overcome by the eyes of love. More so than all the stuff that's in creation. You know, he could be pretty overwhelmed by a galaxy that he created. I mean, I think galaxies are pretty awesome. Or some other, you know, some quasar or something. Or some subatomic, yeah, or some subatomic thing that produces energy or whatever. But he's more amazed by we look at him with love. Because like Aquinas said, we're more important than a star, because someday the star won't exist and we still will exist. And Aquinas didn't even know what stars were. We know what stars are, so it's even more overwhelming. I mean, the sun's kind of a, you know, medium size, not so great of a star compared to the blue white thing and the red giants and all that other stuff. I don't remember all the details about it anymore, but we're more important than any of those. Because, you know, whenever the universe is wrapped up, those stars aren't going to exist anymore, but I'm still going to be living somewhere. As are you guys. Or y'all, as they say in the Southern Kingdom. Down in Mississippi. Do they say shalom, y'all? All y'all. But anyway, so now she's so enthralled by him that she's not just glancing. She's like, oh, good, you're back. So now she's fixing her gaze. You know, she couldn't feel his presence during the time that the test was going on, but he was still overwhelmed by what she was doing. Isn't that cool? She didn't even realize that he was there, but he's overwhelmed by what she was doing during that time. So he's overwhelmed by weak, broken people who love him and want to do his work, which is everybody who's ever done his work. Weak, broken people. Remember, the angels don't have this, and they're way more powerful than we are. And more beautiful. They don't get sick. They don't get bald. They don't get old. They're just like... But see, then you can say to an angel, he likes me better. No, you don't want to make the angel mad. Zacharias will tell you that. Yeah, I'll probably edit that stuff. So isn't that cool? So we might as well read, let's read 6 and 7, because we have to get through this kind of weird stuff.
Your teeth are as white as a flock of sheep that have just been washed. Not one of them is missing. They are all perfectly matched. Your cheeks glow behind your veil.
You don't have a pomegranate there. Oh, man. Who's got pomegranates? Yeah. So we described this before. So he's going through it again. You know, the goats on Mount Gilead were beautiful, and they were well-nourished, and they all moved in a line, and everybody thought that was beautiful. And okay, we'll have to just grant them that. And, it, you know, teeth for eating the word and being nourished, and the temples and the cheeks are, you know, your emotions, and they're like pomegranates. So he's going through just like before. It's dedication. Hair is dedication. Remember, the Nazarites didn't cut their hair, never cut their hair or shave. So there's dedication, there's the word, there's emotions. Now, he went through this in chapter 4 with the same descriptions. At that time, she was just beginning. It was kind of preliminary. Now she's mature in her beauty. And being in the test was part of the maturing process. And later, much later on, Paul's going to write in Romans, everything works together for the good. So all these things work together for the good, including the test. Because if you were never tested, if you were never disciplined, that wouldn't be good either. Because then you get like, you know, fine-tuned, and you get stronger. And if you never have a test, you just kind of go along saying, well, everything, great, great, great. But when you have a test, it makes you stronger, focuses you better. If you remember back in Hebrews, it says, you know, every father disciplines their sons and daughters. And when you're being disciplined as a kid, you don't like it. But then when you're older, like Irina, me, all of us, when you're older, then you realize, boy, it's really good that they disciplined me. Or else I would just be like wild. Okay, now verse 8.
There are 60 queens, 80 concubines, and maidens without number.
That's pretty weird. This is Solomon's court. Yeah, Solomon had hundreds of wives. When the song was written, they estimated he had 600 wives. Or women total. Some wives, some concubines. That's in 1 Kings 11:3. And he was always getting new ones. New queens, new concubines. You know, the, well, yeah. You know, when you're the king, you can. It doesn't work so well anymore. And so the queens, the ones that were actually married to him, had royal rights. More so than, the concubines didn't have any rights. They're just kind of mistresses. Although some of them, like his special ones, owned property, were counted as part of the family. I mean, this is just, I don't know the details of that. Then he had these women that were called virgins that also worked in the court. So, but the thing the groom's trying to explain here is the bride surpasses everybody, even in God's court, which includes angels, you know, and all the created things. The bride surpasses all that. There's different rankings of beings. The bride, which is us, surpasses everything. Remember, Paul writes that someday we'll be judging angels. You can give them an order. You can sit in Lillian's chair until some angel will go get you something. Go get me some iced tea, and it better be cold. So, you know, once again, Solomon, you know, is being a type, describing his court. Okay, now verse 9.
For the loneliness of Dove, my perfect one, her mother's chosen, the dear one of her parents. The daughters saw her and declared her fortunate, the queens and concubines, and they sang.
So the bride is the perfect one. The church is the perfect one. Now she's mature, she's dedicated, she's stronger, she's better disciplined. And remember, the dove is a single person. I mean, single purpose. No peripheral vision. Yeah, my dove, my perfect one. Now, is she perfect? No, she hasn't done anything yet. Are we perfect? No. But he says, you're my perfect one. One, just looking forward, mature in love. You know, in Ephesians 5, it says the church is going to be presented as a pure and spotless bride. You're going to be pure, you're going to be beautiful. And none of us are pure and none of us are beautiful. But he goes on and on about, of all the glorious things that he has, she's the most important. She's what he wants more than all the other stuff. He would die for her. He did die for her. Remember, he died for the church. We've been bought with a price. And we have to take that seriously. We've been bought with a price. And it, you know, it's not silver and gold. We were bought with his own blood. So that's how much he wants the bride. He's willing to die for her. She's captured his heart, which is all of us, more so than all these other things. The mother, again, is the church. God is our father, church is our mother. So our natural mother gives us physical birth. Our spiritual mother, the church, presents the gospel to you, presents Jesus to you. Presents salvation to you. And then people come in to the body. People come into the bride and literally become part of the bride. So if the unrepentant atheist sinner who lives next door suddenly becomes a believer, repents of what he's done, joins the church, is, you know, part of the body, he's now part of the bride as well, whereas yesterday he was outside of grace and mercy. So it's going to be a spotless church, and at the end we're going to be spotless and without blemish. And everybody else praises her. The maiden saw her and called her happy, the queens and the concubines. All the other parts of creation are going to say, wow. That's awesome. So verse 10 is a cool rhetorical question.
fluid is arising like the dawn, as fair as the moon, as bright as the sun, as majestic as an army with golden banners.
Ooh. See, all these things are glorious things. You know, she's compared to earthly beauty. Now she's compared to the beauty in the heavens. She shines like the dawn. You know, after you've had a long dark night, you see the dawn and you go, wow. And even if you've had a miserable night, when you see the dawn, you feel better. You know, where light shows you the way, you know, shows you the way through darkness, shows you the way through evil. And Jesus said we have to be salt and light. Because we have the light. You know, in John 3, he also says, you know, the light came into the world, but men prefer darkness to the light because their deeds are evil. When you're doing something bad, you don't want the light to shine on that. You want it to be secret. But we're supposed to shine light on everything. And the moon, you know, is the light at night. Genesis 1:14-19. The moon doesn't have its own light. It just reflects the sun's light, of course. But it also shines in the darkness. So it's never like completely pitch black if the moon's out. And the sun is, of course, he's going to have the glory that Jesus has in the New Jerusalem. You see that in Revelation 21:23, where we're co-heirs and we rule with him. So if you remember when we did Romans in chapter 8, we have a spirit of adoption. So we become adopted sons and daughters, and we become co-heirs. So Jesus is the true son. We're the adopted sons and daughters. And we're co-heirs to the glory. So that's pretty cool. So when we're all in heaven, we're going to be like, hey, you know, this is mine too. Now 11.
I came down to the nut garden to look at the fresh growth of the valley, to see if the vines were in bloom, if the pomegranates had blossomed.
So, this garden is mentioned 9 times in the whole book. The first 3 times she talks about her garden. The last 6 times she talks about his garden. So, she goes to the garden to partner with him. She told the daughters he was in the garden at the end of the chapter, at the beginning of chapter 6. He's in the garden. And she wants to be where he is. The nuts, and there's all kind of different nuts that grow there, they're used in multiple ways. But they were used for food, they were used for oil, they were used for medicinal purposes. And all that stuff's in the nut, but in order to get at it, you got to break the shell. Because the nut with the shell on it doesn't really do you any good. So she goes out of where she's familiar to see what's going on in the garden. She's now totally out of her comfort zone. You know, we're in the garden in the middle of a fallen world. The whole world's not a garden. But we're in the garden in the midst of a fallen world. She wants to go and see the buds growing. She wants to work with him now so that fruit's going to be produced. She wants to invest herself into it. So now, as she's matured, she's now enthusiastic because of his love for her. And she says, yes, going in the garden now. You know, another way to look at this is the Great Commission. Go out and preach the gospel to everybody. So you say, yes, I'm going to do that. I mean, if you're fully committed, you understand how he thinks of you, and you're fully committed to that, you say, that's no problem. I'll go out and preach the gospel. If you're just sitting in the pew waiting for the thing, you know, waiting for the service to be over, you're not going to go out and preach to anybody. You know, you're fully committed into this now. So she's in the garden. She's looking at the blossoms. She wants to see if the vines are budding. Now, what's that a sign of? Fruit. She wants to see, is fruit being produced? You want not only yourself to produce fruit, but you want other people to produce fruit. You know, the Bible says many times what happens to a tree that doesn't bear fruit. Cut it down. What's the point of having it? I mean, you can have a beautiful, I mean, if you make your living selling figs and you have a beautiful tree that has beautiful leaves but no figs, that doesn't help you. It looks good, but it doesn't have any figs. You know, it's going to be cut and thrown into the fire. You're not supposed to just sit around looking good. But you can have, you know, and I always use the example, of Judas. If you were an observer, and you saw Jesus and those 12 walking around, and you saw Judas with the thing over his shoulder that had all their money in it, you'd say, man, that guy Judas, he's in the in group. Not only is he with Jesus, but Jesus trusts him to carry the money. Like when they went to Denny's to eat, he paid the check. When they went to Starbucks, he reached in and said, oh, I got a card. No. But, you know, he took care of the money. So if you were watching them, you'd say, wow, that guy's really, really in. But you can't, you didn't see what was going on in his heart. He looked good, but he certainly wasn't producing fruit. And 12.
I am trembling. You have made me as eager for love as a chariot driver is for battle. You're saying I am trembling?
No. Somebody else has, but they have.
Before I realized it, my strong desires had taken the chariot of a noble man.
My fancy set me in a chariot beside my prince. Anyway, now she becomes like a chariot. Now, we think that's kind of stupid because we have, you know, cars and planes and stuff. But in those days, a chariot was the fastest way to travel, right? If you had a horse and a chariot, you could get places fast compared to riding on a donkey or having one of those dopey carts with an ox pulling it. Yeah. So kings and rich people had chariots. I mean, you didn't see poor people riding around in chariots. They were for important people. So now she has the zeal that she wants to move quick. She wants to help out fast, and she wants to help out totally, and she wants to be able to get around. So she's totally changed, and she's surprised by this. Before I was aware. See? That's the work of the Spirit. The Spirit equips you to do something, and then you think, wow, I didn't even realize I could do that. So, and, you know, to give you a personal example, when I used to, you know, when I was in training and stuff, periodically you had to give teaching talks to your colleagues, and some of the, you know, attending smart people would come, and, you know, every few months you had to do this. I was scared to death. Make slides, you're researching, you're putting stuff together. You'd be going through the slides, going, and I'd get up there, my palms would be sweating. I'd be saying, then, you know, first time I talked in a church, there's like, you know, 100 people in the church. I said, oh, 100 people in the church. Give me the microphone. You know, we did a, Peter Herbeck and I did a mission. There were 600 people four nights. He goes, oh, we got 600 people coming. I said, great. Give me the microphone. Nope, sweaty palms, no anything. Because it just happens, and then you're kind of surprised. You think, wow, I just talked to 600 people. And then, surprised by all this because she wasn't doing this before. Now she's totally committed and she wants the chariot. She wants to see how the buds are doing. Remember before it was, I'm going to stay in the house. You want to jump over the hills? Go ahead. We'll catch up with you later. She doesn't want to do that anymore. Yeah, so now, see there at the end of 6, see verse 13. Who does your Bible say is talking? You don't have a 13?
Okay. Women are talking.
Okay. Right, the women are talking. There's a 13th verse that some translations don't have.
Do you have one?
It says, return, return, O Shulamite. Return, return, that we may look upon you. Okay, so this is a little bit different. Okay, somebody start reading there. Yeah, 7-1. Read that.
See, we got 6:13.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful are your sandal feet, O queenly maiden.
That's verse 2.
Yeah. It's a little bit different here. So now, the immature believers want to see her. They call her 4 times. Return, 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 return. We want to look at you. You know, she told them this witness, this evangelization. Now they want to see her. This is the only place in the song that she's called the Shulamite. They come from the city of Shuman. It's the same root as Solomon. It's the same root as Shalom. It's the same root as peace. After all, the Jesus and the church are based on peace. So now they want to see her again. They want to learn more from her. They want to be with her. Now they're not mature believers. They're not really sure about the groom, but she told them a bunch of stuff. They want to be with her. Okay, now start reading that. We got this confused here. And these were people, you know, that, remember some of the watchmen had mistreated her. Some of the people that said, oh, what's so great about that? You know, we got beloveds too. But now they want to see her. And there's this, what they're talking about here, about this dance between two armies. It's spiritual warfare. We're always bouncing, you know, we're always getting bounced between the two armies, the two kingdoms. It's a conflict. And there's also a conflict even within the church, even within the body of, you know, there's the fervent people and there's the not so fervent people. And the not fervent people don't like fervent people because they find them annoying. You can see how that happens. You know, they say, dude, you need to relax. You're getting too wound up about this. Why can't you just be normal? So now that we got all the verses confused, jeez. All right, so why don't we start reading it, whatever the next verse is.
How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the handiwork of an artist.
Hmm. You know, in your translation, who's saying that? Daughters of Jerusalem. Right. The daughters of Jerusalem, the more immature believers. So the question was asked, you know, yeah, it's like, you know, who's the Shulamite? What's so great about the Shulamite? Then they answer the question. Before they had a sarcastic question, what's so great about your beloved? But now they start to describe her, and they start to reaffirm what the groom says about her, both in the 4th chapter and what we just read. And they start with the head and work down. So they see, well, actually, no, they start at the feet and work up. I'm sorry. I wrote that wrong. Okay, scratch that on the handout. They start at the feet and work up, unless your translation, unless the other translation. Where do they start in the New American Standard? Start with the feet? Yeah. Oh, I see. He started with the head and worked. Okay. He started with the head and worked down. Okay. I was confused. This different verse thing threw me for a loop. Yeah. Okay. So now they start with her feet. Okay. You know, the feet moving. You know, the feet take you to where you're supposed to go. She's committed to the task. She's committed to evangelization. She takes the good news. Isaiah 52:7. You know, how great are the feet on the mountain that bring good news. You know, when you had a watchman on the wall, which is Isaiah 62, when you had a watchman on the wall and they saw somebody coming, they knew if he was bringing good news or bad news from the way he walked. So if he was bringing good news, he'd be like, doo, 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 doo. If he was bringing bad news, he'd be kind of like, doom, doom, doom. And the watchman would yell, doesn't look good. So the enemy was probably over the next hill or whatever. So the feet take you to where you're going to go. In Ephesians 6:15, talks about, that's the famous chapter about putting on the armor of God. And all the things are defensive except the sword, which is the word. So, you know, your feet take you. can't remember exactly what it says about feet, but so then the curves of her thigh are the strength. Your thighs are the strong part of your leg. So that's the strength behind her walk. And in order to build up the muscles in your leg, what do you have to do? You have to train. You have to exercise. You have to discipline. You have to work. So she's walking with purpose. She's committed to spreading his word. She's strengthening herself. And that's where you get the, your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Now her muscles are all developed. But she looks like goats and all that other stuff. You. I hope we look better than that. Okay, now read the next, actually, why don't you read that whole next section? So we can take this like one at a time up to verse 9. Read up to verse, through verse 9.
Your table is a round bowl that should never lack the mixed wine. Your body is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your breasts are like twin fawns, the young of a gazelle. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. Your eyes are like pools in Hezbon, by the gate of Beth Rabban. Your nose is like the tower on Lebanon that looks toward Damascus. Your feet rises like Carmel. Your hair is like draperies of purple. A king is held captive in his tresses. Go on.
For a minute. That sounds real beautiful. Poets do a much better job of describing beautiful things. So what do we got? The navel. What's the navel? That's where you get nourishment from your mother before you're born. So she's well nourished, has a balanced, good diet, a good spiritual foundation. You know, formative years. You know, when the fetus is being, when the baby's being formed, all the nutrition comes through the umbilical cord. Into his navel, into your navel. So the question is, did Adam and Eve have belly buttons? Yeah. Yeah. The answer, I think, would have to be no. That's right. So after we get our glorified bodies and we meet Adam, we can say, let's see. Pick that robe up a second. I got to see this for myself. Yeah. So it's nourishment. The heap of wheat, you know, it's ready for harvest. So she's ready to bring in a harvest. It's about holiness and purity. Lilies are purity. So it's wheat, it's surrounded by lilies. So through in holiness and purity, you go out and bring in the harvest. Remember, we're bringing in the end time harvest. Those other guys brought in the first harvest. But we're just as important as they were. So it's bringing in a harvest. The breasts, of course, nurture with milk. So now she's nurturing new believers. She's nurturing people that are coming into the church. The bride's nourishing the people that are coming in. Then they get to go out for the, they get to go out for the harvest too. Because after you nurture a new member, a new believer, then you got to get them out to the harvest field too. You know, this is a matter of the whole process. That's why I always say this refers to the church and also refers to an individual. Because if an individual just comes to faith, just comes into the church, they can't stay like that. They have to advance and mature. Like Paul says, at first you drink milk. Then after a while, you start to eat more complicated food. So, you know, he said, gee, I know I come back here and you guys are still drinking milk. You know, you can't have a 10-year-old who just lives on milk. I mean, that would be, wouldn't be normal. So, and it talks about, you know, fawns, twins of a gazelle. So it's young. So young breasts nurture more than old ones. So it's all about, you know, youth and strength. It's a double portion. And the neck, of course, we talked about is the will, because it turns your head and points your head in what direction you're supposed to go. Your neck's like an ivory tower. The ivory is rare and it's costly because your will is supposed to be for him, and that's costly and it's rare. Then it talks about eyes. You know, the eyes have the ability to receive revelation. So now she sees, she has insight into her spiritual mission and what she's doing. These pools of Heshbon were very clear. So he's talking about your eyes are clear like the pools in Heshbon, real clear water. You can see all the way to the bottom. Your eyes are clear. You can see what's going on. In this other place, Bath Rabim is a resort that also has really clean water. And seeing clearly helps with your spiritual growth, obviously. Philippians 3, 8 to 10. You know, when you see what God's doing and you look to revelation and you understand the revelation, you're going to spiritually grow much better than if you don't do those things. Or if you just sit back with your eyes closed and say, okay, I'm just going to be happy to be here. Before she just wanted to sit in the house. Now she wants to focus in on what's going on. And then there's this beautiful description of her nose. Like a tower in Lebanon looking toward Damascus. Well, that's a little weird. So, you know, the tower, the nose discerns things too. It's part of the senses. A tower is protection. Lebanon and Syria were always full of enemies that always came against Israel. They still do sometimes. It's a discernment of what the enemy is doing. You kind of have to sniff the enemy out. You kind of, you know, when you hear something going on, you kind of go, that smells like the enemy. Well, your eyes help too, but, and your ears, of course. When somebody's giving, you know, a really discouraging kind of thing, you know that that's not from God. Or something that sounds like it's not consistent with the scripture and traditions and so forth from the beginning to now. You say, wait a minute, that can't be right. A good quote I like from the Bible Answer Man is, you should be so familiar with the truth that when a counterfeit looms, you recognize it immediately. You don't get taken in by a counterfeit. Which a lot of people get taken in by counterfeits. I mean, cults. Yeah, the best way to recognize counterfeit money is to know what real money looks like and feels like. So when something weird goes by, you go, wait a minute, look, this is wrong. And then look how cool it is in, your head crowns you like Carmel. Your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. What's all that about? Now, your head, of course, has thoughts, right? Your head is where your thoughts are centered. It's high and powerful like Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is a beautiful high mountain. It's a beautiful, fertile area. Everything is really green. We've been to the top of Mount Carmel. It was really awesome. Your thoughts are lofty and green and fertile like Mount Carmel. Not all mountains are. A lot of mountains are higher than it, but it's very fertile and green. And purple, of course, is royalty. Now, only royal people had purple clothes because it was expensive to dye cloth purple. Because you had to have this special snail and you had to boil it or whatever and put your stuff in it. I don't know about all that, but that's why royal purple. Common people didn't walk around in purple clothes. So now you got lofty thoughts and your hair's like purple. It's royalty. You have fertile, high thoughts and you have a royal presentation to yourself. Your hair's purple. Before her hair was like a flock of goats and stuff. But now it's royal and looks like a purple goat. And then captive, you know, he's so caught up in love for the bride. See, it says there, a king is held captive in her tresses, the tresses of her hair. It holds him captive. You know, Paul later writes, a woman's beauty is in her hair. The hair is a sign of devotion. Now it's purple, which means it's like royalty. And her head's thinking whole different thoughts than it was at the beginning. And the king's totally caught up in it. So he's held captive by her. So when people think, oh, God's not going to listen to me when I say something, he's going to listen to you when you say something. He's captivated by you. And, of course, this is all kind of caught up in her ministry and how she's working. And remember, look at it as the church and an individual, too. And then look at, in 6, he goes back to how fair and pleasant you are, O loved one, delectable maiden, or whatever your translation says. He says, wow, this is, you're so fair. This is so awesome. He's lovesick for the bride. And read 7, 8, and 9.
Beautiful you are, how pleasing, my love, my delight. Your very figure is like a palm tree. Your breasts are like clusters. I said, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its branches. Now let your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the fragrance of your breasts like apples.
Good, read 9 too.
Like an excellent wine that flows smoothly from my lover, spreading over the lips and the teeth.
Oof. So we have a little verse mix up here, but okay, but that's kind of that's the thing of it. So now Jesus totally vindicates the bride in all of this that he's doing here. But he's also answering the watchman's questions like, well, what's so great about all of this? Like, why are you guys so hepped up about this Jesus thing? You know, he's saying she's beautiful, she's pleasant, she's bearing fruits. I have love for her and passion for her that's beyond comprehension. The palm tree was also a sign of victory and conquest, Revelation 7:4. It's a picture of maturity, Jeremiah 10:5. You can read that for your homework. And it thrives because of the way the root system is arranged. It grows high, but the winds don't usually knock palm trees over. Like they do, you know, broadleaf trees or even evergreens. Winds don't usually break it. So now as a mature believer, the wind's not breaking her down. Remember when Jesus uses the example of if you build your house on the rock, you're going to withstand what happens. If you build your house on shifting sand, every time there's a wind, a storm, the house is going to fall down. So it's now the palm tree, you know, she's sturdy. She's not going to get knocked over by the wind. You know, you watch those hurricanes, those palm trees are going, but they're not going down. You know, and the clusters, of course, are where the fruit is, whether it's apples or grapes or, you know, whatever it is. So he takes hold of the branches. Remember, he's the vine, we are the branches. You know, apart from me, you can do nothing. You know, a branch can't do anything if it's, you know, you take a branch off of a tree, when you throw it down on the ground, it still looks nice, but you go there the next day and it looks kind of, you go a couple of days later and it's, you know, the leaves are all withered up and, because apart from the vine, you can't do anything. So in John, is it 15, I think, Jesus says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. Apart from me, you can do nothing. The Father plants the vine. He is the vine. The Spirit runs through the vine, the sap and the nourishment that's in the vine. So we're connected to that. We bear fruit. If we're disconnected from that, we just wither up. And, you know, when he talks, you know, we don't live in an agricultural society, but we get that. when Jesus is talking to those guys, they live in an agricultural society. They get what he's talking about. They know what happens if you cut a vine off of a, you know, if you cut a branch off of a vine or off of a tree. So when, once we stay connected to the vine, to the trunk, not only do we live, but we can produce what we're supposed to produce. Fruit. Now I shudder to think what the next verse is numbered. I have it as 10. Well, anyway. Okay. I am my beloved's and his desire is for me. That's actually going to start the next one. So now what he's saying is, in this part that Lynn just read, breasts, of course, are nourishment of others. Now it's operating in a way more powerful way than she was before. Because now she's also more in tune with the spirit. The apples are refreshing. You know, so even her breath is going to be refreshed, and that's going to help others. You know, the breath of her word is going to be more powerful and fresh. That comes from John 20, 22. The mouth is intimacy with God. Remember before it said your kisses are better than wine. You know, it's intimacy. You know, it's through the spirit now, she has a much more intimate relationship than she did at the beginning. And even though wine is, you know, a great joy, and people say, you know, the Bible says wine makes the heart glad, and, you know, they always had good wine, and when people say Jesus didn't drink wine, it just makes me laugh and shake my head. Because of course he drank wine. And they liked good wine. And at Cana he made like the best wine. I never heard that. I tell some of my evangelical friends, you know, when they have their grape juice, I say, come on. Those guys at that wedding had been drinking all day. If Jesus would have made grape juice for them, they would have said, what is this? He made really good. Remember the guy said, hey, how come you got the best wine at the end? So he made really good wine. Yes. And so we can assume that Jesus drank wine. They all drank wine. They couldn't have had the Passover. They couldn't have had the Passover without the wine. But anyway, that's a whole nother argument. So this love and intimacy with him, we have to remember that outside of the Godhead, the bride is his greatest joy and his highest desire. Which is pretty amazing. That's why at the end of, I think it's the very last verse of 1 Peter, you know, it says the angels want to look into these things because they don't get it. I mean, it's like, wait a minute. What do you mean? So her character has changed. Her maturity level has changed. Now she's partnering with him. And because of her commitment now, their intimacy is so much more. They're lovesick for each other, and they're going to work together. So we'll stop it there, even with the weird...